Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
He phoned me up. I actually had a phone call. And he just sort of said, I just wanted to see what this fella's like. He doesn't like me. I said, well, it's not that I don't like you at all. I mean, but, you know, it's just, and I think perhaps I wasn't fair to you. And I talked to him just like to another bloke, because I didn't think he was going to help me. It wasn't like a writer talking to a huge star. But in the end, he did help me with the John Lennon book. And then when I decided I really ought to do the McCartney biography and really kind of make amends.
All right, MUT episode 19. Hope everyone's doing well. I'm Sean Kerrick, and today I'm joined by a really special guest, Philip Norman, who's joined me to talk about Paul McCartney's solo trilogy. When we talk about Paul McCartney's solo trilogy, we're of course referring to McCartney 1 and McCartney 2, released in 1970 and 1980, which are both records where he plays all the instruments, writes all the tracks and produces it, mainly home recordings. And it's becoming a trilogy this year with McCartney 3, released in December 2020. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity to talk about these works that have always interested me, because you see Paul with more of a wild sense of abandon. And Philip is renowned for being a Beatles biographer. He wrote a biography called Shout back in the 70s, which has now sold over a million copies. He's also written comprehensive biographies on both Paul McCartney and John Lennon, as well as other musical greats like Elton John, Mick Jagger, Eric Clapton, and many more. So with Philip's deep knowledge on all things Beatles, we discuss the periods around Paul's solo records in anticipation of this third instalment. Philip also talks about meeting the Beatles backstage in the 60s and the phone call he had with McCartney ahead of getting his approval for the biography. As always, you'll find links to playlists in the show notes, but I've also dropped a few articles that Philip has written over the years. There's a great one on George Martin and one about what it was like being a journalist back in the 60s, which was really, really interesting. Give us a follow on MEAT Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and give us a like and subscribe, and hope you enjoy. Cheers, guys. Philip, thanks so much for joining us on MEAT. I thought it'd be good to get into your background a little bit before we dive into the McCartney solo trilogy that we're going to talk about today. You know, it'd be great to get into your own history with the Beatles and where that started, just because I know that's a particular band that has linked up throughout your career.
Absolutely, fine, yeah.
The really fascinating part of your biography is where you talk about your encounter with them back in, I think it was the early 60s, and where you got to meet them backstage. What was the story there?
Well, I was working in Newcastle-on-Tyne in for a Northeastern daily paper in 1965. At the end of 65, and the Beatles came to Newcastle, and I got into their dressing room. Wasn't really a dressing room, it was more like a sort of big green room at the back, at the City Hall in Newcastle, and talked to them. And this was they were incredibly big by that time. They'd done Shea Stadium, they'd become MBEs, and yet they were so very nice and friendly. The only one who wasn't was George, rather typically. But McCartney let me hold his bass guitar. John and Ringo talked to me as if I was their oldest friend. And like many other journalists, I was completely captivated by them. They were just so sort of nice and normal. But of course, they had a tough roadie called Neil Aspinall, who I came to know later in life. And it was Neil Aspinall's job to be nasty. They were never nasty to anybody. But it was Aspinall who said, get out.
Right,
so I had to get out. And I'd also talked to the Stones, on a backstage staircase as well, in the Northeast. But it never occurred to me then to write about the Beatles, because even in 65, it seemed like everybody else in the world was writing about the Beatles, millions of words being churned out every year about them. No room on this bandwagon for me at all, I thought, until I was on the Sunday Times magazine, which was a very, very chic magazine in those days. It was almost like a standalone magazine, like The New Yorker or Esquire magazine. Had oodles of money from the color advertising. And I asked if I could go and hang around the Apple House in Savile Row. And it happened to be just when they were breaking up. This was in 69. They really broke up in 69. And so I was there really and had a ringside seat. So I finally did start to write about the Beatles, but I still didn't think I would write a book about them.
It's interesting. I mean, that encounter feels so bizarre. Somebody like me, I mean, I was born in 1993, so you know, the image of the Beatles back here, especially back in the 60s and the early days, it seems like it almost didn't exist to me. So picturing actually going in and meeting them at that stage is just sort of bewildering to me, and I can't really imagine it. I mean, and the when you started writing about the Beatles, it was Shout was the was written in the 70s, is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, they'd broken up by then, and they were all on solo careers. But the world was still waiting. They never actually officially broke up, and the world was waiting for them to come back. And there were various rumours at different times they were going to come back. And then it was, you know, the assassination of John Lennon in 1980 that told everybody they were never coming back as they had been. But of course, that started a second wave of Beatlemania, a huge second wave of Beatlemania, which is still going on. You know, because you play a Beatles track to a young child, they're immediately captivated by this music. It has such incredible charm, which is what they had, which what no other band has had to the same degree. It is simply wonderful charm, and it's still is as potent as ever today.
Completely, yeah. I mean, and then, you know, the aftermath of your biography of the Beatles, Shout. I understand when you came to write McCartney's biography, you were almost quite surprised when you got his approval. Is that right?
And that's true. Well, I'd written the John Lennon biography before that, and I contacted McCartney just to sort of say, because I had the reputation of being anti-Paul.
Yeah,
and I hadn't been really fair to Paul in the Beatles bug in Shout, because he seemed so very. He seemed like he was trying too hard to be nice and to be liked, but and people who want to be liked are never quite likable. But that I think was because I was too biased towards John, which of course is very easy to be. However, when I came to write the John book with Yoko's cooperation and cooperation of George Martin, lots of and Neil Aspinall by that time, I did let McCartney know I was doing it and sort of sent a message saying this is not, I know I'm thought to be anti-Paul, but this will not be anti-Paul, I promise you.
Yeah.
And to my surprise, he phoned me up. I actually had a phone call. And he just sort of said, I just wanted to see what this fella's like. It doesn't like me. And I said, well, it's not that I don't like you at all. I mean, but, you know, it's just, and I think perhaps I wasn't fair to you. And I talked to him just like to another bloke because I didn't think he was going to help me. It wasn't like a writer talking to a huge star. But in the end, he did help me with the John Lennon book. And then when I decided I really ought to do the McCartney biography and really kind of make amends for my unfairness to him, which I do admit, in Shout. Again, he was he answered questions by email very, very fully, you know, and I did see, after that phone call, when he phoned me up, I put the phone down and said to my wife, he's not so bad, you know, and I think somewhere he was putting the phone down, he's not so bad, you know. So we started with a kind of clean slate again.
That's great that you could, you know, make amends. And I mean, I guess it's quite interesting that he must have been aware of what you had written about him, and he was just sort of trying to scope out your angle, I guess. But that's really fascinating that he actually sort of wants to get in contact and actually chat to you about it. And I mean, you know, what we're going to be focusing on today is the solo trilogy, which I mean, I get really fascinated with dates and sort of musical lineages through albums, and the McCartney solo canon is a particularly interesting one. And for those listening who don't know, up until this year there were two McCartney records in his canon that were crafts in a very similar fashion, both having been recorded at home where he plays, performs and produces all the tracks himself. McCartney 1 was in 1970, McCartney 2 was in 1980. Now a third has been added to make it a trilogy. So McCartney 3 was made this year in lockdown, or as McCartney has called it, Rockdown. And one of the threads I saw through this, Philip, was the records are, it's almost like a combination of home, family and love, which is a quote from one of his press releases, but you know, because they're mainly home recordings and he was surrounded by his family, but they've also got this, you know, wider thing of difficult circumstances or tragedy. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of 1970, it was that first installment was created at the end of the Beatles. The second one came out just after his very highly publicized drug charge in Japan, and obviously Lennon was murdered in December that year. And then in 2020, it's created in the midst of this global pandemic. That was like some of the threads I saw through the records. I mean, it would be good to start with McCartney 1 because that was made in the breakup of the Beatles. And there's a great paragraph in your book, actually, that sums up the end of the 60s. It's, you write, "For a hallucinatory moment, the hippie credo of love and peace truly seems to have become a force capable of changing the world for the better. Sadly, the musicians who had done most to create this mood of freedom and goodwill were nowadays locked up in endless acrimonious business meetings," which is a bleak picture. And I understand McCartney released a press release with this record that some consider led to the breakup of the Beatles because the press grabbed it and it sort of went wild. It was sort of a self-written Q&A. Was that something that came across your desk as well when that Q&A was released?
Well, yes, and in fact, how it seemed, of course, was not how it really was. Mm. How it seemed that was McCartney was coasting out of the Beatles, not caring really about all the terrific anguish that millions of Beatles fans all over the world were feeling, and coasted easily into a solo album and put a Q&A on the album, which was a kind of sly way of saying that the Beatles were breaking up without actually coming to the point. And that just wasn't how it was. The Beatles had been breaking up for at least 2 years before that in slow motion. They'd come back together because they could, you know, once they got in the studio, they could forget their differences and they could make music like they always had done. But in this case, after their business organization Apple started to sort of hit the rocks, if that isn't a mixed metaphor, Apple hitting the rocks, and in fact Paul had worked the hardest to make that organization succeed. And the record label, the Apple record label, actually was hugely successful thanks to Paul. But John Lennon wanted Alan Klein to be the manager they'd been looking for since Brian Epstein's death 2 years earlier. And John mobilized the other two against Paul. And Paul was marginalized and really shut out and went off to his farm in the wilds of Highlands of Scotland. And really had a sort of nervous breakdown. You can't imagine someone with all this, you know, that he had going for him. Incredible talent, incredible good looks, incredible charm. Incredible popularity, that he could actually be really on the verge of not only a mental breakdown, but also alcoholism as well. But he did, because those four people were so close. They had been so close once, and now they weren't. And he was the one who really was hit hardest by that. And he made the album very rough and ready. He was actually getting short of money, if you can imagine that. He didn't know where he was going. And again, if you look at the chronology, Paul was the one who took longest to make a solo career really work. It was long after John, and long even Ringo was doing better than Paul at one point. But that is the background to that solo album and this Q&A that was packaged with the album. He seemed to be so self-assured, so smug. He was not. He was really wondering what the future held, whether he was going to have a career as a solo Paul McCartney. So appearances are very much different from, you know, from the reality, and they are about McCartney. McCartney always seemed to be so self-assured, so smug, he had a very solid family background, even though he lost his mother when he was 14. So he wasn't like John, obsessed, haunted by the thought of an unhappy family and upbringing. But at the same time, he had this incredible self-motivating energy that was never satisfied with what he did and always wanting to be doing more. And that's why he's still around. He doesn't have to work, you know. And yet he still feels he has to prove himself. That is a kind of insecurity that you can hardly imagine. And yet he feels he has to go on stage every night, you know, for 2 or 3 hours without an intermission very often, without a sip of water. And why he has to keep on putting out albums, and of course why he's put out this album. You know, there are these three albums, McCartney 1, 2 and 3, but there are dozens of others, of course. And it became sort of fashionable to say, oh, he's not as good as he was in the Beatles. And very often he wasn't, because he went into a different genre. It was a kind of the age of the glam rock era, which Wings were. They had the glam rock audience latched onto them, and he wanted Linda, his wife, in the band. And that, a great movie. He just wanted her there. She sort of learned to play the keyboard after a fashion. That wasn't the same as being partners with John Lennon on stage. But at moments all through his solo career, long before he really became huge with Wings and sold actually more units of records than the Beatles had, there were moments when that sort of peculiar sort of lyricism, that amazing talent, that amazingly British talent, it was so British, it was so Liverpudlian, would shine through all through the solo albums as well, and even through the Wings albums, and of course ever since then as Paul McCartney.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always love the freedom that you can see across these, you know, truly solo McCartney albums. I mean, particularly on McCartney 2. I think, you know, on McCartney 1 as well, like you were talking about his... he was in a bit of a bad state mentally, just because he had a breakup of his band and had insecurities about the future. And there are a few songs that are sort of telling of that state of mind, particularly thinking about Every Night, where it's got this really sweet melody in the middle. But when you look at the lyrics, you know, Every Night I just want to go out, get out of my head. Every day I want to get up, I don't want to get out of my bed, which is obviously, telling of somebody in quite a bad way. And I think the album itself is pretty subdued, even though it's got really pretty melodies across it.
It's unfinished. You know, it's quite rough and ready because it was all done, you know, at home and home in London mostly. But of course, what happened was he still sounded like the Beatles in lots of places because he was so much the Beatles. But it wasn't. But what really made the Beatles was the symbiosis, you see, between two very different personalities who got into each other's heads creatively. So it all was based, to my mind, on the fact that one was left-handed and one was right-handed.
Interesting.
John could play Paul's left-handed guitar. Paul could play John's right-hand guitar. And they could switch personalities in the same way. So one could finish a song that the other had started if he couldn't think of a way to end it. And that's quite extraordinary. It's very, very rare in a songwriting partnership for both partners to do the words and the music. But I can't think of another example, really, except those two.
Yeah, it's a very, like you say, with the swapping of the instruments in the left and right hand as well, it's such a deep connection that they had. It's sort of incredible that they were able to do that.
And also, you know, John was later on complained bitterly about Paul's granny music, as he called it, When I'm 64, you know, on Sgt. Pepper. And yet, John, in the studio, did everything he could to make it sound as good as it could sound, you know, with harmonies. His harmonies on that are totally charming. You know? Each is kind of tagged with a sort of a label, like John was the rocker and Paul was the tuneful one. Paul could be a rocker. Paul used to do all the the Richard numbers, the Jerry Lee Lewis numbers, when they were just starting. Sean was incredibly romantic, and loved Bing Crosby and, you know, all of that sort of that schlocky stuff. When there were still records on cylinders, John loved all of that and the British musical. And Paul loved the musical. And there was this incredible meeting of minds over music. And that was enough in those years because, you know, pop music was an endangered species. You know, it was only the young who didn't have, you know, they had growing economic power. But the establishment, the grown-ups, really ruled the world. And the young were in a sort of underground movement, and their music was underground music. Yeah. And it took a long time for that to switch around completely, so the young were totally in charge, mostly thanks to the Beatles, of course.
Definitely. And was it around this time where I read in the biography, he used to have a dream about Alan Klein as a demonic dentist?
He was right about Alan Klein, that has to be said. John was kind of seduced by Alan Klein's kind of salty New York wit, which was very like Liverpudlian wit in a way. I've interviewed him, he was really funny. Yeah. But Klein was just a crook, you know, and like all crooks, could never imagine he'd done anything wrong, like nearly all major crooks are the same. You know? They think they're the soul of sort of righteousness. Paul wanted his soon-to-be father-in-law, Lee Eastman, Linda's father, who was a very, very successful showbiz lawyer in New York, to be the manager in the sort of the old sense of a manager, rather like Brian Epstein had been. No one could be quite like Brian Epstein. And he would have been very good. And in fact, Paul's brother-in-law, John Eastman, had a lot of experience with dealing with bands like Chicago, an American band, big American band.
Yeah,
that would work. But John was kind of won over by Alan Klein, and Klein spun him a story of having a hard childhood, you know, and all of that. Klein took very good care to be nice to Yoko as well. And so in the end, you know, they went with Klein, but almost immediately, which was rather sort of hard on poor old Klein, they were visibly breaking up. And nobody thought in those days that a band could break up and still go on being huge, you see, which of course the Beatles did, more and more huge.
Yeah.
The more years after they broke up.
Yeah, it sort of seems sad to think that it went from such a creative period, I mean, particularly in the late 60s, starting off with Sgt. Pepper and the White Album, and then within the space of 2 years, you know, just crumbling like that. It's so you can see, you know, why...
Very short. The time was so short, you know. And in those, I mean, who could... The Rolling Stones, who were the most unstable band of all 60s bands, you know, one of them found dead in a swimming pool, two put into jail, all of them bankrupt by the end of the 60s, you know, and condemned by everybody and harassed by the police and the FBI and God knows who else. But they would still be going all these years later. And with the Beatles, it was all so short, and they packed so much creativity and such incredible development of their music in that time, in those few years.
It is incredible. It's incredible looking at the dates, especially compared to now, where bands take around, you know, 2 or 3 years on average to create an album. It's very different now. But these McCartney, the solo trilogy anyway, they seem to come at points in his career where he's at a bit of a dead end, or it's almost like a reset or a zero point for him. Because, I mean, jumping forward to 1980 at the release of McCartney 2, this was sort of came at the end of Wings. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but their last tour was in 1979. And this was around the time when McCartney started tinkering away at this new record. And I believe he had access to one of the first 16-track recorders, which is he just had some more tools in his shed that he could use to put together an album. And McCartney 2 is a bit of a strange one, I guess, because I feel like the legacy of the album is more positive than it was received at the time, because it was using a lot of forward-thinking recording techniques. It was influenced by modern bands like Kraftwerk. What are your memories of that album coming out? What was your maybe initial reaction to that?
Well, the whole thing was overshadowed, of course, in so many other ways. And, then it's death, of course. But you know, McCartney's imprisonment in Japan for what seemed to be a completely ludicrous offence. He'd been warned he couldn't because of an earlier brush with the Japanese authorities. You know, he wasn't going to be let back in. He finally was let back in, and then this right on top of his clothes in his suitcase is this, you know, little stash is found.
Yeah,
and he is incarcerated for something like, I think it's 11 days in all. In a really tough, not given any kind of special treatment, given in a really, really tough prison with lots of Japanese mafia and convicted killers.
Wow.
But what was extraordinary for him was that it was quite restful. He almost enjoyed it because it was like a brief holiday from the pressure of being Paul McCartney. You can't imagine.
Right.
What pressure someone like that is under, and what he was under as one of the Beatles was even more, because their life really was quite horrible quite often as the Beatles, and it was like being in a rather tough sort of health farm, you know. And he had to make his own little bed, and he just had a holiday from being Paul McCartney. And Linda said he'd been sort of institutionalized, and he had really, because he was a very turned out to be, and must always have been, a very positive person, decided it would be a positive experience, and it was. Eventually, international, you know, diplomatic activity got him released. But it wasn't like being traumatized by this at all. You know, he was, he felt he'd benefited from it, because basically this is someone who, despite all these decades of being adored, adulated, praised, honored, he still has basically sort of, you know, is basically a decent human being. And he could take a lesson from that, because he had his father had to bring him and his brother up after their mother.
Yeah.
A tragic death. Was just a wonderful man who just instilled the right values into them. Jim McCartney, the father, never earned more than about £10 a week on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange, as it was in those days. They had a big family circle, so there was, you know, a feeling of great security, and lots of aunts around, good aunts, that sort of thing. But he basically still has the values of his father, because that's what stick in everybody. You know, if you get the right values when you're a child, then they stick. And also his father was a self-taught pianist, completely, who loved Hollywood musicals and Broadway musicals and English brass band music and traditional English country music, all that. So that's where Paul got that sort of very melodic and very traditional side from, which surfaced most sort of, I suppose, most remarkably in the Sgt. Pepper album. And which John responded to. Paul had started thinking if he'd write for musicals almost before he met John Lennon at the Garden Fete. So there was always this very, very sort of deep vein of tradition in him. But again, so many other sides to this man. You think of John, John's not just a musician. John was an artist, and John was a poet, and John was a peace activist, and John was a wit, and John was a writer, and all those things. But Paul, there are lots of other sides to McCartney which rather got overlooked. I mean, this is really his artistic side, because he had rather wanted to go to art school. He didn't go to art school, but he used to sneak into the art school that John was at. He and Paul and George used to sneak in there because they were adjacent buildings in Liverpool.
Right, yeah.
But now nearly every the later Beatles albums were Paul's idea or something to do with Paul. He could do things like build a brick wall. I mean, rather like Winston Churchill. He won the Second World War and he built a brick wall. And Paul, you know, thought up Sergeant Pepper, and he built a brick wall. It was something he built for. I mean, it was like a patio for his dad. Yes, house he bought his dad. He could cook. He could do things like that. You know, he was an all rounder. But of course, the greatest quality was this music, natural, untaught musical genius.
Completely. And I mean, the untaught nature of it as well gives even a sort of a wilder freedom, I think, because I think in particularly you see that employed across these, McCartney 1, McCartney 2 anyway, because it was the first time he was messing around with synths, and it was almost like a new language to him. So you definitely see that carrying across. And I know on, I think on Check My Machine, he samples some dialogue from a Tweety and Sylvester cartoon. And I mean, that's very forward thinking because, you know, a lot of rappers and people who create mixtapes do that all the time. They take little samples from movies and put them in. So that's what I really enjoy about the solo works to date so far. There's a real creative freedom, and he really doesn't worry about, you know, going wild too much. And I think he said around McCartney 2 as well, is half the joy was knowing it wasn't going to be released, so it was, you know, never intended for release. It was more just an experiment. And it seems it's the same thing with McCartney 3 too. Did you, I mean, at the time, or, you know, now retrospectively, are you a fan of McCartney 2? Do you find any joy in that record?
Well, after I've written one of these books, which are all incredibly hard work,
I imagine,
and always make me wish I hadn't started and vow never to write another one. I throw all the books away, the reference books, and really don't listen to another note of their music. I think probably Jimi Hendrix is the one exception to that. I sort of appreciate him as a person, I think, more, because it was never kind of believed that someone who was so nice to the fans, and always nice to the fans, wasn't always a nice person, but who is, you know, that he was always charming to people who wanted his autograph and that sort of thing, where the others weren't necessarily. They sort of learned it from Paul, really. And you think, oh, you kind of suspect someone like that, you know, being a PR man. We didn't know what PR man meant in the mid-60s, quite honestly. But he was a natural PR man. He would organize them to pose in the right way for a photographer. Even a photographer who stopped them on the street, Paul would group them in, you know, a nice way for this one picture.
Wow.
And one couldn't quite believe someone could be as positive and as sort of basically kind and nice as that. And he really is. Niceness and kindness are very hard qualities to convey in print. It's very rare you can make a nice person into an interesting character in a novel. So Charles Dickens can do it. Very few people can do it. And I've had to do that a few times. I had to do it with Buddy Holly, who Paul's big idol, of course, and John's big idol. Buddy Holly was only 22 when he died. And he was essentially a good young man, a very, very religious family, and a thoroughly nice and decent person. And to convey that quality is very hard in writing without making them seem boring. And and that's McCartney as well. You know, there isn't really, you can't really say anything bad about him. John, in the aftermath of the Beatles breakup, was furious with him. But I can't even quite see why, you know, because John wrote this very horrible song called How Do You Sleep?
Yeah.
Which was a horrible song. And of course, the only thing you'd done was yesterday. John knew that was a complete lie, of course, when he wrote it. And what John didn't know was that Paul had written on the Wings' first album, I think it was the first one, Wildlife. There was a song called Dear Friend about John. If John had heard that, I mean, he would never have written How Do You Sleep. That is such a sweet song about John by Paul. And that's really, you know, he couldn't really keep a grudge going. And even sort of that nuclear assault from John, he sort of passed it off. And because he had this sort of, there was more to him than just a rock musician.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you talked about the sort of niceness and being able to portray that, because there is a lyric on the new album, which I haven't heard yet, but I've been reading some reviews, but the lyric that a lot of reviews have been talking about is "It's still all right to be nice," which is one that stands out on one of the tracks. So it's almost like he really is self-aware in that way, as in he knows that might be the depiction of him, and he's playing up to that, it seems, across this album. And I think with McCartney 3, it's going to be interesting because obviously it's for one, it's 40 years since McCartney 2, and I guess in a way it's another dead end, which is what you see across McCartney 1 and McCartney 2, because I guess another dead end reared its head in 2020 when the pandemic kicked off. Obviously Paul was going to be playing Glastonbury and was going to be doing some other shows throughout the year. And I think the interesting thing is he's employing the same techniques he was using 40 years ago, But now it's almost the norm, and everybody's recording in their bedrooms these days, which brings that, a real freedom in terms of the fact that you can be on your own schedule, or you can release things as and when you please. As we've seen this year, Taylor Swift's released 2 records in lockdown, even though she does have a lot of producers at her beck and call. But there's so many other people out there. I mean, I know, I didn't actually think about the fact that you probably would have had to listen to so much McCartney stuff and Lennon stuff when you're writing the books. But will you be tuning into McCartney 3 when it comes out? And what are your thoughts about this approaching a year like 2020?
Well, yes, a lot of people have had to rethink, how they put out their music, of course. And, recording was so very different back when the Beatles made their first albums, of course, with George Martin, even by 1970 and in the 70s. It was still all, massive, first of all, massive selling singles, then massive selling albums. Now that's completely different. And in a way, the sort of... The communication is much more immediate with the artiste, because the way that music got in the 70s was sort of blown apart by punk rock. There's what used to be called snob rock, with these extraordinary sort of labyrinths of sound. People like Yes, those snob rock groups used to do. So in a way, it's sort of got rather back to basics, which every so often popular music has to do. But the thing is that basically, pop music only consists, because it really comes from the blues, which only really has 3 or 4 chords. It only has a certain number of chords that it can use to be a rock song, but it's what people can do with those ingredients. It's what a great cook can do, with some baked beans and sardines. And what an appalling cook can do with the same, or can't do, it's just how... There's nothing really new. It's only new ways of seeing material. And he is one of those people who always be new, because what is so rare in not only in pop music or rock music, but in any music, is the ability to write a melody. And nearly every song that you hear is not really a melody. It might have evocative chords, it might have a great sound, it might have a great voice. But actually, an original melody is really the hardest thing in the world to write. And he seems to have an inexhaustible supply.
What's your take on music in 2020? And, maybe some of, you could call them Paul McCartney's peers in 2020, whether it be Taylor Swift or people in the rock world. I mean, do you still tune into what's going on now, or do you keep it relatively, in the music that you listen to in your youth?
I don't really listen to music. The only thing I really listen to is a community radio station comes out of Havant in Hampshire, called Angel Vintage, it's called. The presenters can be in their 70s, their 80s, or even their 90s sometimes. And they play an extraordinary range of music, with mostly sort of pre-rock and roll 50s music. Frankie Lane, people like that, but also lots of hardcore blues. And the older the presenters seem to be, the more they seem to like the more hardcore music. And that's what I like to listen to, because it's such a funny station to listen to, because sometimes it goes dead, and then the presenter, who may be in his or her 80s or 90s, says, "Oh, sorry, I switched the studio off by mistake. I think I've lost it forever," and it suddenly comes back. But in general, I don't know, really. And as I say, once I've written a book about someone, I rather sort of throw the music away and try not to think about it, because I think about it too much at one time, and think about nothing else.
Definitely, definitely. That's understandable. One last question. Obviously, we are coming up to Christmas at the moment, and I wondered, what is your favourite out of the Beatles Christmas songs? Paul McCartney, Wonderful Christmas Time, or War Is Over by John Lennon?
I don't think of them either, really, much. I don't think I like any Christmas record. Oh, there's a dreadful thing played on Angel Vintage called Dominic the Christmas Donkey. Have you ever heard that?
No, I don't think so.
It must be as bad a record. It must be as bad a record as Jess Conrad's This Pullover. which has won every contest for bad records ever been held. It's been won by Jess Conrad's This Pullover. But Dominic the Christmas Donkey has now beaten it.
I've got to check that one out then. I'll add that to the playlist. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking, Philip. Real pleasure having you on and hearing your stories and thoughts about McCartney.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. What are you working on at the moment? Are you having a bit of downtime? Are you got anything else in the pipeline at the moment?
I've written a book during the lockdown. I've written a book, actually, and thinking about another biography for next year already. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Great. Awesome. Thanks so much, Philip.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.